Hey, welcome to the Joe Scarborough Podcast. This is the thrill of all thrills. We have with us now the star of Donnie, which was just it's one of those moments in time that you just sit there and you're like, where were you when you saw Breakfast at Tiffany's? Where were you? You know, I could go through it all, but that was a sort of cultural touchstone, I think, for all of us growing up, Donnie. Welcome to the show.
Well, I'm thrilled to be here, my friend. How you doing?
I'm doing good. How much fun was that acting in Donnie, this comedy about your life?
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the most fun things I ever did. It was a faux reality show, kind of like a Curb, where I played a fictionalized version of myself, even a bigger asshole than I am in real life.
Oh, please.
And actually, you had a great critique of it. It lasted one season. The problem was it was on broadcast. It needed to be on streaming. It was a little before its time. It's just it was on a Tuesday at 10:30, and the kind of audience, a much higher-minded audience, is not watching appointment TV. But you said I needed to even be a bigger asshole than I was on it, that I should have even pushed it further.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, you are so right. Like Larry David, who always pushes it and goes further than he would in real life. It was still a lot of fun, though. And we got a look, sort of this faux look into your life, which I thought was great.
It was fun. And you guys were part of it. A lot of media cameos. It was great. It was one of I'm really proud of it. As I said, it was only one season. But the fact that I was able to get a show that I wrote and starred in on USA Network was a real accomplishment. So yeah. It was just fun.
So it's so interesting when you're on the TV show, we're talking about politics, news of the day. When we're together, if we go out to have dinner or whatever in New York, we're talking about our personal lives, our families, our kids. Mm-hmm. I've never really done a deep dive into your background, your career, everything else. Talk about your career because people now, you know, we introduce you as an advertising and branding icon, which you are. And it's so interesting. I had a friend in Pensacola who I thought was just an extraordinary talent. I mean, one of the most talented people I've ever met in my life. And you were like his hero,
oh, wow.
Which again, it's interesting that I know we laugh because it's interesting that because I know you so well, I have to keep reminding myself of really sort of your place in the advertising world over the decades. So talk about where it started.
I've had a couple of careers. The second half has been the media world, obviously being on Morning Joe is a big part of that. But for the first kind of 20, 25 years of my adult life, I took over my dad's ad agency, joined him when I was, you know, in my mid-20s. Actually, I first started off at a big agency, Ogilvy & Mather, then went in with him. And it was a small boutique, a print boutique, and I surrounded myself with some great people. We were able to kind of really blow it up. Deutsche Advertising, when I sold it, it was the largest independent agency in the world. And we were known as real brash and real cutting edge creativity. It was a couple of billion in size, you know, in terms of billings. And I was kind of in the industry. This is a horrible, horrible analogy. There were a lot of parallels to what Donald Trump was in real estate. I was in, this is pre-President Trump.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I was the most high-profile guy in the industry.
You were sort of an outlaw in your own industry.
Very bombastic and always getting—
The polite firms didn't like you.
Yes, yeah. We were the upstarts and we would get, tremendous amounts of attention. But we kept kicking ass and we were like ad agency of the year for like 4 years running. We were kind of, I would say, in the late 90s till like 2010, I think we were kind of the agency in the country. And it was a great run, a lot of fun. I sold it at a relatively young age. It was interesting. I sold it at 43. And the reason I sold it, I got a nice chunk of money, obviously. But I always say to people, never sell your business because of money, because you can't go visit the money in the bank every day. I did it because I kind of felt I won the game. I'd walk into a three-hour meeting. I knew I was going to end in 60 seconds. I just kind of like felt I played every chess move. I also, it's such a service-oriented business that I found myself on a August afternoon in the backyard. It was the president of Mitsubishi. He was a big client of my Mitsubishi cars. And it was his daughter's sweet 16. It was an August Sunday. And I was there. And the banker wasn't there and the lawyers weren't there. But as the ad guy, you're just so service oriented.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't service anymore. I couldn't be on those backyards on a Sunday, at somebody's daughter's sweet 16 where I outgrew it. And
where you had your own kids, have your own family. So Donnie, this is You know, I'm always fascinated by what make people successes. There are so many things that I cannot do. There's some things I can do where I walk into a room. As far as negotiating goes, I can walk into certain rooms. And like you, I know how it's going to end. I know how to make everybody walk out of the room winners when mm-hmm. you know, I'm doing all right. And that's something they just don't teach in school. I'm curious about you, and I'm curious about where you learned that, because there are other people who just have these incredible instincts. The only reason I brought myself up is there are tons of things I can't do. There's certain things I can do just on instinct. You the same way. You talk about going into these huge meetings, and you're in there, and even before it starts, you know how it's going to end. Where do you learn that from?
Growing up in Queens, you know, I remember going to University of Pennsylvania my first day and meeting all these kids that had gone to all kind of, you know, Greenwich High School or
right.
all Waspy High School, all Jewish high schools. All, you know, right. My high school was 4,000 kids. It was fully integrated. It was a tough school. And I grew up on the streets. Right. I mean, I grew up a comfortable life. I don't want to make my life that I grew up, you know, poverty, walking to school for it.
Right.
But I mean, I took city buses to school every day. I played softball on concrete. And you kind of had to have your wits about you. You know, you really, in other words, when I went to high school, you couldn't go into the bathroom unless you knew the right people. You know, it was a kind of, I grew up in the streets, and you just have a certain, I remember getting a pen and meeting all these kids. And I said, I couldn't wait to play cards with them and take their money and drink their beer, because they just didn't have what I had. They didn't have that kind of,
yeah.
One of my books, I wrote a chapter called Queen's Logic, and it informed a lot of what I did. It really, I had the best of both worlds, because I had parents who, you know, gave me a private education, and I grew up in a comfortable, nice home. You know, we were like in the nice neighborhood in a tough school kind of thing. And it was the best of both worlds.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. Tim Russert always told the story of when he went to work for Senator Patrick Moynihan. He walked into the office the first day, and everybody there was like, you know, the students you were talking about that you went to at Penn, and they were all had Ivy League degrees. They all went to the best prep schools. They all came from the right families. They had all the right connections. And Russert, after the first day, tells a story that he went to Moynihan and said, you know, what am I doing here? I can't keep up with these people. And Patrick Moynihan said, Tim, you can learn anything they know.
Sure.
They will never be able to learn everything you know. I thought that was a great insight.
It was in the movie Wall Street when Gecko says, you know, give me city college kids hungry, you know.
Right.
And the challenge for us, when I say us, I mean you and me and other people who've been successful in life and have a degree of affluence, is how do we instill that hunger in our kids? How, you know, there's a luxury of being hungry.
Yeah.
I remember dating my first wife, and I remember going and she was very wealthy, a certain wealth compared to her. And I remember her brother had a Porsche at 19 and a speedboat. And I remember saying to myself, that's not fair. Don't do that to a kid, you know? You can't rob a kid of the luxury of being hungry.
Yeah, and you know, the thing is, growing up, you would look at all the kids who had, you know, the money and the connections, the kids that belonged to the country clubs, whatever, and I would always at least think, wow, that must be nice. And the older I get, the more I realize how fortunate I was to grow up with my dad, who basically, you know, gave me a middle-class life and gave me, you know, a good last name. He was a good, upstanding guy. But no shadows, no long shadows being cast. I've got, you know, people that listen to this podcast know Joey's producer. Joey runs it. But I always say that my children don't have that luxury, because we sit here and we've always thought this, that the kids that grow up and families, whether they're affluent or well-known or whatever, talk about how lucky they are. I can tell you, I was extraordinarily lucky, because, again, my dad took care of me. He provided for me. My mom did the same. But no shadows cast, and I could just go out, kick ass, and people go, hey, wow, okay, that guy works hard.
Yeah.
It's much, much harder for our kids. I'm not bitching and whining. I mean, and obviously they have some breaks, but it's like you said, there's some real disadvantages there. And looking at both sides, I'm glad I had the life I had growing up. Hey, Donnie, stay with us. We'll be right back with more on the Joe Scarborough Podcast.
I wish this bag under my eye would just go away. If that sounds like you every morning, you're not alone. Bags and puffiness under the eyes are a problem for millions of American men and women. Until now. Introducing the new Genucel Serum with plant stem cell technology from Chamonix. Susan from New Jersey wrote this. I've been using Genucel for a couple of months now. The puffiness around my eyes is gone. Even the crow's feet and small lines have disappeared, and they haven't come back. I love your product. I use it under my eyes, around my cheekbones, and on my eyelids. And it's not just Susan, folks. The word is spreading about Genucel. I love it, too. And with its instant effects, you'll see results in the first 12 hours or your money back, guaranteed. From now until Thanksgiving, save up to 60% off on Genucel's most popular package at Genucel.com. Go to Genucel.com now and enter my special promo, GOJO, for an additional $30 off. Right now, 60% off Genucel's most popular products. Go to Genucel.com. Genucel.com. That is Genucel.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Joe Scarborough Podcast. Now back to Donnie Deutsch. Let me ask you about your ad career. Is there one particular ad campaign that you were the proudest of? One particular ad campaign that stands out among all of them where you go, holy shit.
Yeah.
I can't believe I nailed that the way I did.
Yeah, there's one without question. It was in the early 90s for IKEA Furniture. And we were doing a campaign that showed kind of different lifestyles that buy furniture. And we showed two gay guys shopping for furniture. This is 1993. And it was two guys. And at that point in the media, you didn't have depictions other than like Liberace and
right.
These stereotypical, ridiculous, you know, takes on what gay people felt like and looked like and sounded like. And this was just two guys shopping for furniture. And it was historic. It really was. And as I remember Oreos in 2014 did something. We were there 20 years earlier than before anybody else. And
did you get any kickback from it?
Tons. The reason it was smart for IKEA was only in urban centers. So I got thousands of, you know, hate mail. But then I got thousands of thank yous. Just thank you for showing it. Like they got that gay people had a representation of them somewhere in the media.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm most proud of. You know, anytime, look, when you're hired as an ad agency guy, your job is to build shareholder value for your clients, you know, build their business, sell their products. But if every once in a while you can move something forward from a moral compass point of view, certainly not at the client's expense, but in hand with that, that's very much, I love that. And I also love they worked on the Clinton campaign in 92. Yeah.
Let me ask you about IKEA before you get to the Clinton campaign.
Yeah.
Was IKEA happy?
Yeah.
Did you make them money by doing that? Did they get bottom line? Did it grow?
They did. They got IKEA, their brand also, and are kind of around the world. They always look for their advertising to be controversial and create noise. So it was the right client to do that. I would not have done that for Chevrolet at the time.
Right.
It wouldn't have been right for their business. For IKEA, it was right. It was what they were, you know, their mantra, their tagline in the world is furniture for all, you know. So the company is about inclusivity and breaking barriers and cutting edge. So it was the right company to do that. And it certainly did help their business a lot.
So talk about the Clinton campaign in 92. What did you do there?
Yeah, you know, it was interesting. We got hired by actually Stephanopoulos and Mandy Grunwald and Carville were running the campaign. And they brought in, you know, a few general advertising specialists like my agency. It's different what you do in a political campaign than for the clients. When IKEA comes to us, for instance, or Taco Bell, we do their entire strategy, their research. We kind of mold where they are. When you get hired, at least when we got hired, you're more of a production company. Like they'll say, okay, we're not the ones deciding strategically. I think we should do an ad about education. We're directed. Go do an ad on education. So it's a little bit of a different creative muscle. You know, you're not like they're the guy driving the ship. So I wasn't the one plotting out what Clinton was going to do. We were executing, but it was still a lot of fun. I remember one fun thing was riding around the bus with him. We shot all the documentary. I actually still have, I guess I should send it to the Library of Congress or something. All this footage of just Clinton on the bus. It was Clinton, Hillary, the Gores, Secret Service men, myself, a sound guy, and a video guy, just cruising around on the bus. It was just surreal. And what you realized at that time about a political campaign, the sound bites you see is all they're saying. He would get out of a bus. He would say, we're going to tax everybody making over $200,000, health care for all. Good night, everybody. Get back on the bus. Deflate. You know, well, this crudité sucks or whatever it is. And then get back out and the same thing. So what we are, and you would know this infinitely better than me, but a campaign that is on message is on message. And they are just repeating the same fucking thing day in and day out. That's what I found interesting about it.
You know, and that's actually, that's one of the things I learned. I went to a campaign manager school in 93. They didn't know I was a candidate. No candidates were allowed. So I just said I was going to be a campaign manager. I was young enough to get away with it. And so some of the best advice I got out of it was, and I always remember this, guy said, listen, here's the deal. You're going to say the same speech. You're going to do the same speech thousands and thousands of times. And you've got to understand that when you say it the thousandth time, and people that have heard it, you know, and your staff members, your family members, they all have heard it so much they're about to throw up. Just then is that message breaking through.
Yeah.
And you got to do it another thousand times. Yeah. So it's so interesting that you say that. That is a thing. You just have to keep hammering that message home.
Yeah. And Clinton never disappointed. I remember the first time we met, we were interviewing myself. There were six or seven ad people, and we were interviewing the then governor. And I said, so governor, what should I say about you in the ads? What's so special about you? And while nobody was looking, he goes, he holds his hands and he goes, big feet, say I have big feet. I mean, you know, he
never disappoints.
Never disappoints.
I had a friend who was traveling with him from Pensacola, where he gave a speech, and they were driving to Tallahassee, but they get out of Pensacola, they're going down I-10, and he's going east, and he's like, I need some fried mullet. Where's the best fried mullet? And somebody came in, and they said, well, Mr. President, it's about an hour and a half north from here, and so we're going to be late. He goes, I want the mullet. And so they drive all the way up. Go hour and a half out of the way. Clinton gets his mullet, gets it back on the bus. He starts eating and he goes, there are no hush puppies here. We're the best hush puppies. it was a traveling circus with Bill. You know what's so fascinating, though, about, and you and I talk about the Democratic Party, and I think we're both, in our own way, cheering for the Democratic Party
sure.
to push back against the illiberal forces in the Republican Party that actually are not speaking out against the storming of the Capitol on January the 6th or the constitutional abuses from the last administration. But we've talked about how far left the Democratic Party has gone, and it was, I think, about a year and a half ago, a very astute observer said to me, isn't it crazy that no Democrat running on Bill Clinton's 1992 campaign or running with Bill Clinton's platform from 1992 could ever win today? And we all took that as like conventional wisdom. But actually, the past is the future. You look at Eric Adams in New York City.
Oh, yeah, man.
You look at where the Democratic Party is going. I think my theory that the Democratic Party is actually going to expand and it's going to look much more like an FDR coalition, that could happen. And Democrats could dominate for a generation if they're only smart enough to walk through that door that you talk about all the time.
Yeah, Joe, we talk a lot about this on the air. I know you and I are in the same place. Not everybody on our network feels the same way. Look, this country lives actually just right of center, believe it or not, but it's certainly at the center. And, you know, basically Eric Adams in New York, he ran on safety. You know, it's the opposite of defunding the police, and we're going to be progressive, but at the same time, we're going to worry about business. And I went to a little, I don't know if he would say this in front of millions of people, but he said it in front of a small group. He said, he gave a little speech and he says, you know, I'm really looking out for that guy who drives the limo, but I understand the guy in the back of the limo is important. and what we need to kind of do there also. And it's not an either or. We can have a soaring stock market and also, I mean, stock market's at an all-time high yet. The bottom 50% wealth of this country has increased by 30 or 40%. They've had the hugest jump they've ever had. So it's not an either or, but I think at the end of the day, most people want a strong police force. They don't want to be super woke. They want jobs. They want better education. They want better health care. It's not that complicated, but the Democrats are going to be in trouble if they are focused on some of these social woke messages that even moderates and a lot of progressives really, when they close the door and they pull their sheets up at night or not, don't want to hear. And it's not what they care about. It's not what they worry about. And, you know, as far as the Democrats can run from AOC, and I'm just using her as a poster person, you know, for a lot of the very far left kind of hard reaching things. We are not a country that it wants to be socialist. Although young people do, socialism for people between the ages of 18 and 34 is actually a positive word, and that's a little stunning. But this country, there is room. If a candidate, a Democratic candidate surfaced and did kind of recreate that Clinton space, they would kill it. They would absolutely kill it.
So what do you say to progressives that would say, well, you're only saying all of this because you're a white guy, because you're a rich white guy. You have no credibility. Your day has come and gone. The Democratic Party now is more diverse. It's more progressive. And yes, we're not afraid of socialism. What do you say to those criticisms?
I'll say you're going to lose for the next 50 years. And that's it. You know, because if you just look at every election, it comes down to those swing voters, those suburban voters. That, you know, there's 5, 6, 7, 8% of this country in play in every election. And maybe a generation or two from now, it will be different. But if you want to control the power base in this country in 2024 and 2028 and 2032 and 2036, that message is a losing message. I'm not talking about a moral imperative. I'm not discussing even the issues. I'm talking about winning and losing. And one is a winning formula and one is a losing formula.
Well, and, you know, the electorate's so locked in place. You're talking about Wisconsin, Michigan, mm-hmm. Pennsylvania, Florida, Arizona, basically right now, and Georgia. And it's so interesting. I grew up in the suburbs of Atlanta. My family grew up Democrats in the late 60s after the chaos of 68, early 70s. The radicalism that they saw, their TV sets, the Chicago Convention in 68, just all of the, you know, whether it's the sexual revolution or the drug revolution, you know, raising a bunch of kids, those Democrats, they became Republicans because of the chaos. Donnie, mm-hmm. Democrats, again, have a chance to reverse that back because now people in the suburbs of Atlanta are watching supporters of Donald Trump, you know, rush into the Capitol, rub excrement on the walls of the Capitol, talk about taking over the U.S. government with violence, just running through one constitutional norm after another. There is that opportunity. But again, it's like Connor Lamb out of Pennsylvania said, there's got to be, then let's just use the word, a return to normalcy. Does that mean normalcy of the 1950s? Does that mean turning our back on civil rights advancements? No. Does that mean turning our backs on the advancement that women have made in the marketplace, in government? No, absolutely not. Not on LGBTQ rights, on none of that. But a return to normalcy. I remember it was such a shock to Democrats when log cabin Republicans came out and said, we're voting for Republicans because, you know what, guess what? We make money and we pay taxes too. There's this blind spot I've found in the past with Democratic leaders in Washington, D.C. They think all Hispanics think the same. They believe all black voters think the same. They think all LGBTQ voters think the same. No, they don't.
Yeah.
You've got to play not just to the middle ground of middle-class white voters, but to the middle ground of all voters.
100%. Amen. Amen. Yeah. It's not, and I think the candidate going forward that gets that and weaves that coalition together and talks to a white voter and a black voter as voters and understanding they both are worried about their families and they're both worried about their jobs and they're both worried about their health care. And that's the problem that the world divides it that way. And look, let's see what Youngkin did. I mean, he's got the playbook. And what they did as far as going forward with Trump, as far as just, keep him in a little box, pat him from a distance, but basically play the game. And he ran a really smart campaign. Obviously, there was a sinister quality to it. But at the end of the day, he came across as Mitt Romney. And that was a winning formula. And the Democrats made the mistake of just saying, he's Donald Trump. He's Donald Trump. He wasn't Donald Trump.
It didn't work.
People aren't stupid,
It didn't work. I mean, he kept Trump. Weren't you fascinated? He was able to keep Donald Trump in a little lockbox.
Yeah.
Really humiliate Trump by saying, don't come here. You're not wanted here. You're going to make me lose if you come up here, in so many words. And Trump stayed in that little lockbox and he allowed Youngkin to win. I mean, boy, that sends a message to Republicans across the country, I think, in competitive races. Hey, stick around. We've got one more break, and then we'll be right back with more on the Joe Scarborough Podcast. Hey, we're all getting older, and I can tell you, I've heard about a lot of diets. I've talked to a lot of people about how they lose weight as they get older, and it gets harder. And I have so many friends who are excited about Noom Weight and their psychology-based approach to getting people on track to eating healthier. And here's a great thing. You don't go by a strict set of rules. Noom Weight actually empowers you with practical knowledge to build smarter, more sustainable habits and behaviors. And they use a cognitive behavioral approach, and it helps you focus on the why instead of the what to change your relationship to food and your relationship to eating. And you know this, everybody's journey's different. And Noom believes it's about progress. It's not about perfection. None of us are perfect. Noom's not going to tell you what you can eat or what you can't eat because Noom doesn't believe in good or bad foods. Instead, they're going to give you the knowledge and the wisdom that you need to make for informed choices that are going to fit your lifestyle. An off day is totally okay. And that won't set you off course. Noom gently helps you get back on track. And Noom only asks for 10 minutes of your day to teach you about eating habits and to check on your progress. More than 75% of users complete this program. More than 60% of users lose 5% or more of body weight by 16 weeks. Man, that's pretty great. And more than 60% of users engaged with the program keep the weight off for a year or more. Noom's published over 30 peer-reviewed scientific journal articles about the science that goes into their approach to helping people achieve a healthier way of life. So start building habits for healthier long-term results. Sign up for your trial at Noom.com/Scarborough. That's Noom.com/Scarborough. Hey, welcome back to the Joe Scarborough Podcast. Now back to Donnie Deutsch.
What do you think Republicans are going to do in 2024?
I just, I've underestimated, I've known Donald for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And I will say that Mika and I did predict that the guy could win the Republican nomination and he had an outside shot of getting elected president when just about everybody else was saying it could never happen.
I was with you.
But I've underestimated him. Every step of the way since then, I think I've underestimated, unfortunately, a lot of people in my old party and have been shocked by what I've seen from my old party, from evangelicals that grew up in the type of churches I grew up in. I never want to underestimate it. My head tells me he's not going to run again, but my gut tells me that he probably will because the guy just has to stay in the middle of the spotlight.
Yeah, I mean, I think he absolutely will, for one simple reason, as you just said, his drug of choice is attention.
Yeah.
That's always what more, and why wouldn't he? It gives him something to do. Like for him, the fun thing is giving speeches and doing basically a reality show every day. So why would he give that up and just play golf or just kind of recede into the background? It's just, unless he's had a change of his DNA and his essence. But every, you know, to him, running was never, it was never about, I want to lead the country. It was about, I just want to be in the center of the universe. And I just want to feed myself as much of that heroin and oxygen as I can. And so, yeah, I can't see what would make him not run unless he gets ill or unless some of these indictments come and it just becomes overwhelming, which they will. I mean, you know this as well as anybody, that the government, particularly I'm talking about Cy Vance's office and Letitia James's office, is like, they're going to not do something. They haven't spent the time they've spent in the year. And Mike, they haven't brought in.
You really think that? Because I must say, this looks like one of those movies where Rollo Tomasi gets away with it. I mean, this just, everybody keeps saying, you turn on our network, you turn on other networks, oh, he's going to get busted. And they're setting him up to get, he always gets out of it. He's always the guy that gets away with it. You really think that somebody's finally going to indict him for a crime?
Here's what I think. I think what he did, what he's done, and it's on public record, is just bank fraud, insurance fraud. Right? You value one property for a loan at this and one property for the same property for insurance for that reason. And, I mean, just absolute stuff that you go, Jeff, for. And if you kind of go on the premises, if I'm a crusading district attorney or I'm a crusading attorney general or whatnot, why wouldn't I? Especially when they've spent, you know, Michael Cohen has been dragged in, he told me, I think, for 11 meetings for 47 hours. And what are they doing? You know, they're not doing it to not do it. I mean, I guess I keep coming up to that. And I just think that also I'm a believer in the universe and the powers of the thing, and that somehow if this gets unpunished, the world doesn't make sense. What the world has taught us is unanswered aggression breeds more aggression. And if somehow a guy who is behind trying to basically topple our democracy, and when that's not a hyperbole, that's just real, and we all know that,
it's real.
In great detail, somehow if that doesn't get punished, it's all over. And I think the powers that be in the universe will, and it'll be on taxes. It's not going to be on because what he did January. It's not going to be because of the real crimes to humanity. It'll be just like Al Capone went down. He didn't go down for murder. He went down for taxes. So I do believe he will be indicted on some of these financial misdoings. Once again, he can still run for president, but I think that's going to sully the waters a lot for him.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'll believe it when I see it. You know, any member of Congress would have been thrown in jail for what he did on, where he made a payment to Stormy Daniels right before the presidential campaign.
Yeah.
And he did it. It was the timing of it. That was a campaign expense. He did it to in furtherance of his political campaign. The feds would have looked at that from any member of Congress, any senator, any House member, as a crime.
Yeah.
He got away with that. We'll see if it's different in New York. All right. Well, Donnie, thank you. Before we go, I just wanted to ask you about New York City. You know, you were sort of my go-to guy during the pandemic, and I always asked how things were going. Well, I was up there this past week, as you know, right after the marathon, and the city was just exploding. Is New York City back?
The city is back in a big way. The energy is there. The thing that is the two challenges going forward, and I don't think New York is different from too many other places, are going to be commercial real estate, because so many companies have learned to, hey, let's have everybody work at home. And retail. Retail is still really – you know, if you go – the energy in New York is amazing, but if you drive up and down Madison Avenue, you'll see a lot of empty stores.
Yeah.
Retail's got to figure itself out and become more experiential. You know, the days of just X amount of stores selling X amount of shit are over and going to continue to be over. So what do we do with all of those storefronts to make them commercially viable? And I just keep coming back to companies and financial institutions and healthcare companies have got to find ways to make those spaces experiential and something that is just not purely come in, give me $10, and I give you this product, because those days are over. But overall, the city's in a great place. We got the right mayor now. The last mayor was a fucking disaster. And by the way, everybody thought he was a disaster. You know, no matter where you were coming from, he was just a weak leader.
So you know, let me. I like Bill de Blasio.
Nice guy.
Why? Do people dislike Bill de Blasio so much? When you look at crime rates under de Blasio, pre-pandemic, they plummeted. You look at the fact how aggressive he's been on vaccinations. New York City's infection rate way, way down compared to other cities per capita. So why? This is always something that's always fascinated me. Why such a negative cloud around Bill de Blasio?
You know, I have one major issue, and I think this is a generational mistake. The fact that we had a chance to build a second city with Amazon, literally, that would have been New York 2.0. And the hundreds of thousands of jobs that would have created, and the would have doubled down on the city. You basically, New York would have become a tech center. And what does that mean for the next 50, 100 years? And the fact that he presided over that not happening, to me, you're just a big fucking zero. That trumps, no pun intended, everything else. That would have kept this city going in those shots only come up every 50 years, and he dropped the ball.
All right, we'll leave it there. Donnie Deutsch, speaking his mind as usual. Donnie, thank you so much for doing this.
My pleasure, buddy. What a privilege to be on.
I greatly appreciate it. And talk about your own podcast, if you will, for a second.
It's on brand, and it's a simple premise that everybody, everything is a brand today. Every person, every religion, every politician, every company, every product. And we do two things on the show. I interview a person about their own iconic brand. Mr. Scarborough has graced the presence. And then I do a Brands of the Week thing, where I kind of go over in the past week which brands, including politicians and products and companies, who's up, who's down, and kind of do 15, 20 minutes on that, which is kind of fun. And it's just, I've had some great guests and really enjoying myself. And that's on brand with Donnie Deutsch, iconic.
It is iconic, baby. So really quickly, before I let you go, what's the hottest brand right now? What brand is just going straight up?
Great question. I guess you would have to say Amazon. You know, if you just look at what it stands for, where it's coming in people's lives, how it is just becoming omnipresence, not even the right word. Just it is part of who we are as a culture and a society. And both whether you look at it from a pure economic point of view or from an impact point of view, you would have to say Apple also. You know, these are the, you know, look, you've got six companies now that make up, I think, 15% of the S&P. You know, I mean, it's just, you know, it's Amazon, it's Google, it's Facebook. It's now obviously Facebook's brand is challenging, but that's the world right now. And that's where it is. Yeah. But I would have to put Amazon at the top of the list.
All right. Donnie Deutsch, thanks so much. We'll talk soon.
All right, my brother. Love you, man.
All right. Love you. Bye. Thank you so much for being with us on the Joe Scarborough Podcast. Hope you have a great weekend. We will talk to you soon.